MCOS, that's 20,000 employees.
State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order. January 27th. Thank you, all you hearty souls, for being here. You must be true Minnesotans from way back. Members, thank you for being here. Today, we are going to take care of some information that we've received and gather a little more information and perhaps pass on some messages to other committees. And then the main part of the committee will deal with new monies that we've never talked about or didn't know the correct amounts before conference committee in the springtime. So the agencies that receive new monies at their requests or new monies because they convince the Senate of needs that the House did not completely understand or accede to before conference committee. We're going to talk about and listen to what are the plans and what's been developed with the appropriation of the new monies that we voted on in the final bills. First item on the agenda today is the bonding requests that came before our committees or that are in the agencies that came before our committees. And in your packet is a one-piece sheet, which is not all the bonding requests from the agencies necessarily, nor are, and there aren't any individual members' bills on this list. But they're projects that the agency has requested money for, and in some cases the governor is requesting money for also, and they may be requests that I have a question about that are on here. We have 20 minutes for the agencies that are listed on the sheet, and we're going to start with evidently military affairs. Mr. Kerr.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the executive director of the Department of Military Affairs. We did provide some reading material for you today. I'll just bring it to your attention and I'll focus on my briefing. There is a letter in there that looks like this from the Adjutant General. I put that in there because this is one of the statutory reports that we provide to the chair, and this shows what we spent asset preservation funding on in the previous year, just to give you an idea of how we use that money. Also, I wanted to point out there's a discrepancy. There's the second enclosure of that report looks like this, and there are some changes in numbers and some added projects that I'll brief you on today. When this report was crafted, this was the best data we had, but we did receive some good news from the governor later, and we're able to add some projects to our request. Also in your packets for your reading pleasure, our annual report is out there. I won't discuss this today, but we'll be happy to answer any questions in the future. And with that, I'll move right into my briefing. So our capital budget request this year is for $7.625 million, $1.244 million for an addition to the Brooklyn Park Training and Community Center, $1.381 million for an addition to the Owatonna Armory. That's a little deceptive. The addition isn't actually to the armory. The addition is to the military vehicle storage compound. But the statute requires that we have by name approval from the legislature before we do any expansions. And so that's why those two are listed by name. The remainder is $5 million in asset preservation funding to be used around the state. And on the next slide, we'll get to that detail in a minute. I have some detail regarding the Brooklyn Park project. That's the next slide in your packet.
We don't need a whole lot of detail.
Yes, ma'am. Basically, this adds a second-story department in addition to the building, along with a larger motor vehicle storage area. We also have our project in Owatonna that really adds only space to the motor vehicle storage area, but also does a renovation to the building, including a new roof, new windows, and some other interior upgrades to the heating plant and electrical system in the building.
Mr. Curran, these two projects, the federal money has already been given to us or set aside for us?
Yes, Madam Chair, and these we don't need a buying line from the feds on these projects, so the funding does exist in our budget to execute these projects if we get the state funding. This slide, Madam Chair, identifies the specific places that we think we'll spend that $5 million. Of course, all these are estimates. We don't really know what the projects cost until they're complete, but this is where we intend to spend that funding should it be provided us.
And Mr. Kerr, there was one other item on Building 11-1 or something, geothermal, and it was replacing some boilers. And the governor is not recommending funding for that. And what happens to that project then?
Madam Chair, and members, we are looking at alternative methods of funding that. There's a possibility of using the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program through the Department of Commerce. And that's the path that appears to be the most fruitful for us at this time. So we still intend to pursue that project, but are looking at other means for funding.
Okay. So, and then is it the geothermal method of heating that would be used rather than the old-fashioned heating in the boilers, or...
Madam Chair, it's actually a fairly extensive project, a proposal that would really provide a large amount of the campus at Camp Ripley with both heating, cooling, and potentially electrical generation using biomass that exists on Camp Ripley. We're pretty excited about the project. We're just looking at the most appropriate way to fund it. And so we'll probably be hearing about that project, but we don't anticipate coming to ask for general obligation bonds to support that.
And could that be done also with asset preservation money?
I don't know that it could or not, Madam Chair. I'll look into that, and I'm sure it could somehow be put into a bonding bill, but it may need to be stated specifically for that purpose. I don't think we could use general asset preservation funding because it would be an expansion of existing infrastructure that requires legislative approval.
I see. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, the reason we do this and the reason it's important for us to maintain our fleet, since it is so timely, I just wanted to point out to the committee that as of this morning, there were 52 stranded travelers in Olivia that we put up overnight because of the weather, and 69 additional at Albert Lea. And if we didn't maintain these facilities in the outstate areas, we wouldn't have the capability to provide that.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That completes my briefing.
Questions? Thank you very much. Department and Administration. Mr. Yocum. And then we're going to follow up with amateur sports. Mr. Carlson. Mr. Yocum, I just have two questions about agency relocation and statewide CAPRA. You're asking for $1.5 million for agency relocation. How many agencies is that? Oh,
Madam
not
Chair.
Mr. Yocum.
Members, my name is Wayne Wislowski. I'm the Senior Director for Real Estate and Construction Services within the Department of Administration. Relocation funding, you'll note that's a federal fund request, and that's a typical request that we include in our in the bonding year. This is to facilitate movement of agencies either between leased facilities where there's changes to their programs or where there's opportunities for them to have savings through relocation or through construction projects like Minutes request repurposing data center space. This would provide funding for moving agencies into those spaces.
And CAPRA?
CAPRA is, Madam Chair, members, is the state's emergency funding account, and this is a standing request that we have in each of our bonding requests to maintain an account in case of emergency situations for heating systems that fail or anything that's not covered by insurance coverage, so unplanned, unscheduled events where we need to make capital improvements. The alternative, of course, is to call a special session, which would come to obviously significant cost impacts of doing that. So the idea is to have a pool of money. It's available to all state agencies. They have to submit an application to the Department of Administration explaining what the request is for and how the funding will be used.
Do you have a priority list of where that $2 million would be spent?
Madam Chair, this isn't anything that's planned. So this is if in 3 months a heating system fails at one of the correctional facilities, or if there's storm damage at a park, state park, this is for emergency use. So it's not anything that's scheduled. It's an ongoing appropriation that is maintained.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess what I'm interested in hearing is whether or not some of that money in contingency might be helped to facilitate either the move or the tunnel for the new state office palace, the Senate office palace that we're building across
that
the street.
That is not part of our discussion today, Representative Benson. We're not talking about the Capitol. We're not talking about the state office building. We're talking about basic things. Well,
pardon me, Madam Chair, but
that the bonding committee
the testifier,
is going to ask for information about.
Pardon me, Madam Chair, but the testifier did say that this was contingency money. So I'm interested to find out whether or not potentially any of that money could be used in facilitating the move for the Senate office building. Please
address the committee.
Madam Chair. Representative Benson, no, this would not be used for anything related to the new legislative building. And we'd be happy to provide a report of how this funding's been. We submit an annual report on how this money is used in the past, and happy to forward that report on to you.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Is MMB in any shape or form, though, beginning any kind of work on the building as a bonding request for a later date?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, the funding source that was identified in the legislation that was passed last year was lease purchase financing. So there's a couple of forms of that. General obligation bonds.
Representative Swatsky? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Carlson, followed by John Eichten. Mr. Carlson, I would like you to talk about National Sports Center tournament fields and the Urban Sports Center planning for St. Paul and the asset preservation for the National Sports Center.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I get a chance to get in front of you on different occasions. I'm here as a volunteer today. I've been an appointed member of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission since 2003, and I'm here on behalf of our board. And I have with me Barkley Cruz, who's the communications director for the commission. Of our small appropriation that this committee gives us of about $280,000, we have three staff people, and Barkley is one of our gifted staff at the commission. We submitted five requests, and the three that you want to talk about, Madam Chair, an expansion of the tournament fields for soccer, lacrosse, and rugby at the National Sports Center in Blaine is a $3.9 million request to expand on property that we currently own at the facility in Blaine. We have a use for these fields already. You know, we operate the largest soccer tournament in the country. We have, I believe it's over almost 1,000 teams that come to the Schwann's Cup and utilize that facility. It's an unbelievable experience for the participants. We have the need to expand. We have use to expand our number of soccer fields, and that's what that request is for. The urban regional sports planning is something that we have been working with Chair Hausman on, and I don't know that request is fully ready for prime time. It's in our queue, but in our requests and priorities, it's down about number four out of five for us. And the asset preservation is for safety code requirements at the Schwann Super Rink and energy efficiency mandates. We believe we're in the governor's request for those asset preservation updates, and our number one priority, which you didn't ask about, but I'm a lobbyist and I kind of feel compelled to at least let you know, our number one priority that was recommended by the governor is the Southwest Regional Sports Center in Marshall. That community is ready to go. It's shovel ready. They're ready to turn dirt, and that, from the commission standpoint, was kind of our number one request.
Mr. Carlson, just for clarification on this and other people who thought they were going to talk about more higher priorities or whatever, the bonding committees from both the House and the Senate toured the state and had their opportunities, and the various individual members' bills were also toured and visited. And so since that work has already been done, and the request had been submitted to the Department of Administration and then published, and the city's got to make their requests and that kind of thing. The bonding committee, capital investment committee, of which Representative Dan and Representative Detmer both sit on, are far beyond where we are today. And so I just wanted to review these things, because Representative Hausman is going to ask the chairs and the people on the committees for any more further input,
right,
while they put their bill together. But really, it's the Capital Investment Committee that will be putting their bills together. But I wanted to make sure that we took them up so that the members on this committee would at least know what was going on. And I think we had heard about the Southwest Regional Center a little bit last year. So
you've been very gracious with your time, Madam Chair,
and
during our request.
But what would be the economic impact if we do more fields at the Sports Center?
You know, I'm gonna let Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Cruz.
Answer that. Although, you know, we do have millions of visitors that come to that facility, and the spinoff is significant.
Mr. Cruz.
Madam Chair, the economic impact of Schwann's USA Cup, that one 10-day period in July, is about $21 million of out-of-state money coming in, and the additional fields would allow us to grow the economic impact by $2 to $3 million. The return on those fields would be immediate. In other words, we can grow the tournament and fill those fields in the very first year they come online.
Great. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'm one that puts a high priority on asset preservation. So what was that $475 going to cover? Was that parking lots, roofs? Can you give us any idea?
The asset preservation is mostly for energy efficient lighting. It's repair costs. There's some leakage issues that need to be addressed as well. So it's energy efficiency through lighting, heating, and repair of leakage.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I thought when you say repair of leakage, then that would be roofs.
I believe so. We can get back to you on that.
Yeah, if you don't mind, let me know at least what the roof repair would be.
Correct.
In terms of protecting our assets.
It's not, Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, it's not broken down in our request to MMB, and we can do that for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Acton? Minute?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Nice to be here. I believe I was...
You have this bonding request, but you don't. We generally don't think of data and technology as being bonding projects.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and members, so the majority of the costs involved in data center consolidation, which is a part of the larger... excuse me, IT consolidation strategy are not bondable costs. It's the cost of literally moving equipment from separate data centers into one consolidated enterprise data center. The costs that relate to this bonding proposal, though, are for the repurposing of the existing data center space that is in state-owned facilities back to office space. So as over the next couple years as we, well, 2 to 3 years as we consolidate these systems and hardware in the enterprise data centers. One of the two that we've identified as secure, redundant enterprise data centers. These bonding dollars would be used to return those spaces to office space so that the agency could use it or lease it out to another entity and really achieve the efficiencies at that data center consolidation promises, because those spaces won't just be sitting on the books as a cost for the agencies after we move the equipment out.
Okay. And Mr. Acton, there's a significant difference in the amount of money from your request and what the governor is recommending. How'd that happen?
Well, part of the request, Madam Chair, was general fund dollars for the Freeman Building, which is not a state-owned facility, so we couldn't use bonding dollars for that one. The governor did not include the Freeman portion in his proposal, and so we end up back down at about the $1.3 million for five different state-owned facilities.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, Representative Benson.
I guess I need some help on understanding the urgency in terms of a bonding request on repurposing. Will it change it from a cost center to a profit center? Is that what you're saying? And could we get a detailed report of the kind of square feet that we're talking about, and when it's reconditioned, be reconditioned into what kind of, you say office space. Does that mean, we're going to see partitions and desks? And I'm sure that's not all part of a bonding bill, but certainly I'd like to get more information regarding that before we take a vote on whether or not that's a high priority.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, there was a study commissioned in 2013 by the Department of Administration, a pre-designed study that looked at the cost of repurposing for each of these locations along with associated square footage. I'd be happy to provide that to you. In terms of the urgency, I guess I would put the urgency more on ensuring these systems are in dependable, reliable facilities. So our staggering of moves is sort of along that schedule, and the funding is being requested simply because the funds are not in the agency's budget, they're not in Minute's budget, they're sort of external costs that are coming along with the consolidation of data centers. Well, we'll in over the long term really see that savings in terms of energy and space, but we want to ensure that agencies aren't left holding the bag for space that had been a data center that, in order to make it functional again, requires some investment to return it to office space. Now, whether it would be used by that agency or might be leased out by the Department of Administration to another entity, I don't have that answer at this time.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Thank you. I would appreciate getting the report that came out in 2013. And I guess what I don't hear you saying is that none of this bonding money is used for the actual consolidation. That's paid in a different way, and that's already been funded. So this would just be the repurposing piece.
Mr. Acton.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, it's correct that the funding would not be used for the migrations or the actual consolidation. It would be used for the state-owned facilities that, in order to be made functional again, would have to be repurposed back to office space there. They've been retrofitted as data center space, and unless we just want it sitting unused, it needs to be repurposed.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Representative Benson.
Just for this committee's purposes, at least, and I'm hoping you're familiar with the report, because we'll get it and we'll be able to read it. My only concern is, and when there's space and it's repurposed, somebody will feel like they need to fill it up. And I'm not in a hurry to fill anything up. So, in terms of giving this due consideration, I just hope that as a committee, with all the great things that we will hear about, is that we'll take a real hard look at whether or not we want to repurpose space for office space to just have somebody have the ability to fill it up again. Thank you.
Mr. Acton, will you prepare a follow-up to Representative Benson's questions?
Absolutely. Chair Thank Murphy, you. Representative Benson.
Thank you. Mr. Kelleher? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Leidecker. Excuse me, Mr. Mr. Acton.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I thought he might be able to comment on, are we talking about a lot of space here? Is this going to be a big windfall, you know, for agencies? I suppose it's going to be in the report that we're all going to get, but maybe you can just comment. Are we talking about a lot of space here?
Mr. Acton.
Madam Chair, Representative Leidecker, I might defer to the Department of Administration, Wayne Wislowski, to answer in terms of the exact square footage. He would have that.
Mr. Wislowski.
Madam Chair, members, Wayne Wislowski with the Department of Administration. The largest of the data centers that are being moved out of, the largest one is in the Stassen building. It's 2,900 square feet. There's also about 428 square feet of space in the lab building, the Ag Health lab building. And then there's some space in the Centennial building, about 1,000 square feet of space in the Centennial building, but that'll also be outlined in the pre-design report as well that Mr. Acton referenced.
Thank you. That satisfies me. It doesn't sound like an enormous amount.
No, and they're getting smaller.
Yes, Madam Chair. The idea is to reduce the overall data center footprint by about 70%.
Thank you. Mr. Kelleher. On our sheet, we have five programs that were your top priorities for the Historical Society, and we talked about them a lot. In the spring and in the 2013 bonding bill. Two of the items, the historical site asset preservation and Fort Snelling pre-design, were acknowledged by Governor Dayton as his priorities. This committee in past years and have been led to believe that we get the biggest bang for our buck in the county and local historical preservation grants. And we've always liked those because they're usually competitive grants that are awarded throughout the state. And many of our constituents work hard on the programs that they provide the grants for. And We've thought in the past that one was really special. And then we know that the Oliver Kelly farm serves a great educational purpose to citizens of all ages throughout the state. And that's your top priority. And you were asking for almost $20 million, and the governor thinks that $3 million suffices, and how are we going to what pitch should we make to the bonding committee for the Historical Society's priorities?
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society, and you gave a good run-through of the various requests that we've brought forward. I'd quickly mention that we handed out a booklet that has some additional information about each of those requests. There's a summary of those requests on page 3 of the booklet that shows them in priority order, and then there's additional information about each of the projects, and on pages 6 and 7, there's some additional information about the Oliver Kelly Farm and Historic Sites Asset Preservation that give a list of the individual projects within asset preservation that are in ranked order. I guess I would say in general, as you mentioned, the Oliver Kelly Farm project is the number one priority for the Minnesota Historical Society. It's been on our list for many years. The legislature has given it a green light or a yellow light numerous times in the past, and its time has come. The building is a 1970s vintage earth-sheltered building that is failing. The skylight is leaking. There's inadequate space to accommodate busloads of kids, both from a classroom standpoint and a visitor facility standpoint, like restrooms. So we really want to continue moving forward on that project to better serve students in particular. And I think you all know that ag is an important industry in our state, and this facility is located just on the outskirts of the metro area, and it provides a great opportunity for millions of families and school kids to learn more about agriculture, both in the past and today. So that would be the top priority for us. As you mentioned, Madam Chair, the county and local historic preservation grants have been very successful. Those have been funded in nearly every bonding bill, regular cycle bonding bill, over time. So we would appreciate some support for that program as well. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about specifics of the individual projects.
Thank you very much. Mr. Freeman?
Thank you, Madam
Public
Chair.
Public Facilities Authority, followed by Veterans Affairs. Mr. Freeman, we don't need a whole lot of background on Public Facilities Authority, but your request was to the bonding committee, my understanding is $52,000 or $52 million, and the governor is recommending $32 million. What happens when there's, if it's only $32 million?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, for the record, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the executive director of the Public Facilities Authority. We did send around a handout that I believe you all, one page with our little pipe logo at the top, that describes the two PFA bonding requests, our first priority being the state matching funds for the clean water and drinking water revolving loan programs. That's state funds to match estimated federal grants in 2015 and 2016. Those funds are all used primarily to make low-interest loans to cities for wastewater, stormwater, and drinking water infrastructure. That's our number one priority because of the leveraging that we can get from that fund. Those funds, you can see the note there that each $1 of state match has generated over the life of these loan programs $13 in construction and $3 in interest savings. You can see some information about the two revolving funds below that. And then the number two request is the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, or the WIF program. This program provides grants based on affordability criteria to high-priority wastewater projects on the Pollution Control Agency's project priority list. We recently did a WIF report that's been submitted looking at the entire priority list, and the estimated WIF needs on that list. You can see the note there, $99.2 million for 69 projects that are ranked in the essentially the top half of that priority list. We do know that less than half of those projects in any given year are actually ready to go to construction, and we don't make the grant award until the project is ready to go to construction. So the funds that are awarded are based on the priority ranking on the project priority list and the project's readiness to proceed. So the governor's recommendation for the $20 million, we'll follow the priority order down as far as we can. We work closely with USDA Rural Development, also the DEED Small Cities Development Program to package grants, coordinate funding, and stretch the dollars as far as we can. So at this point, we don't know exactly which projects are going to be ready to go for construction in 2014. We'll have more information as we get a little further into the spring. But that's the answer is we'll follow the priority list as far as we can.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mike McElhenney, Veterans Affairs.
Good afternoon, welcome. Madam Chair. Mike McKelly, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. As I believe you're aware, we have just three items going forward for the bonding request this year. One is for asset preservation for our 50 buildings, nine of which are operated 24/7, and that asset preservation request is relatively minor in nature, tuck pointing, porch repair, mechanical and electrical replacements, and the like. The second one is a request for $700,000 to do some deep tunnel repairs at the Minneapolis Veterans Home campus. We've done some repairs in the past, but it's leaky. The tunnel walls are starting to collapse, so we need to do some work there. And then the last one is for $1.84 million for both Laverne and some work at Silver Bay. Mostly Laverne and Silver Bay, there's going to be some room repair. They're going to repair some wallpaper and do some painting in a lot of the rooms, but also at Silver Bay, they're going to replace some of the hardware in the bathrooms that are shared to prevent the spread of disease control and health care needs.
Thank you. That completes the bonding quests that I have questions on. I'm going to go to the fourth item on our agenda, and I hope to complete it today. And so if we run over, we know that there's no one else that's following in this room, and so I would like to complete the meeting today. The first item on the agenda is the Department of Military Affairs, and I asked Mr. Kerr to come and talk about sequestration. I know that affected the various units across the state, and I heard about it from people in the 148th, and I'm sure many of you also heard about what happened with sequestration and how it affected the department, and are there any after effects of it? Mr. Kerr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name again is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. And our agency was affected by sequestration fairly dramatically, and will continue to be. We have a short respite because so much of our funding is federally generated. The passage of the current federal budget has delayed the effects of sequestration, at least through the next fiscal year. So we're looking very carefully at what those long-term impacts will be. What we're seeing as an immediate effect now is a discussion that's ongoing at the national level about the size, roles, and missions of the Army's three components, the active component, the reserve component, and the National Guard. And we expect that's going to get nothing but more contentious here over the short term, and are working closely with our federal congressional delegation and our chain of command to ensure that logical steps forward are being taken that protect the governor's capabilities for the state mission of the National Guard. That's our primary concern at this point, providing defense for the nation and the right defense and the right mix. So, Madam Chair, that's really the immediate ongoing effect of sequestration. Clearly, we're anticipating reduced operational tempo and reduced equipment recapitalization in the component. And perhaps, I don't know, Madam Chair, if you'd like me to talk a little bit about what the federal government shutdown impacted, because I think that may be more of the impact that you and I discussed
right.
Earlier. And, obviously, it's a bad thing for anyone when the federal government shuts down. Some of our employees were affected directly. More of our employees than we originally thought would be affected because so many of most of our state employees are federally reimbursed either 100%, 80%, 75%, or 50%. And when the federal government shut down, we were no longer authorized to obligate funds to pay those employees. So we had to notify them that at the period that's allowed by the bargaining agreements, we would have to lay them off if the federal budget impasse were not resolved. That caused great consternation in our force. It's a consternation we wish we could have avoided, and one that we're taking steps to see what other arrangements we can make moving forward in the event that the feds are at some point in the future unable to pass a budget that will result in a federal government shutdown. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Were the employees repaid when they went back to work? When the government reopened, if you will, were they made whole for the period that they lost? Did any of those temporary layoffs, if you had to, did that result in long-term, are they back to work? Can you give us a more complete picture of an update?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, there were a small number of employees, less than 20, who were actually laid off immediately. They were state military employees who were laid off immediately because they had no bargaining agreement to protect them from that. We did bring them back after 3 days. They did not receive those 3 days back. That is not something that we were able to do. All of our non-military state employees are protected by bargaining agreements, so they were given a 21-day notice of their potential layoff. And the federal government was restored before we got to the 21-day line. So none of those employees actually went through anything more than the not insignificant concern about whether they were going to have a job or not when those days expired. So we did not make whole our state military employees. We were able to bring them back on in less than 21 days and before the end of that period of notification. So it was really only a few days for a handful of our employees.
Follow up.
Representative Benson.
Are you able to technically do it for these state employees, make them whole? I mean, I know the federal government's not going to give you the money for it, but I'm wondering whether or not those employees, the 20 I think that you mentioned, if they could still be made whole.
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, it was our determination that it would not be appropriate for us to do so because we would be paying them for work that they did not complete as state military employees. And we have some latitude with our civilian employees, but we really don't have that in statute with our state military force.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
So they were required to be laid off. In fact, the 3 days, you couldn't punch them on and then later decide whether or not you could pay them. Is that what I understand?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, yes, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelly, Ms. Sanson, Ms. O'Brien, Minnesota Management and Budget have been asked to come and tell us about their new initiatives that were funded in 2013 in the budget, $5 million for the enterprise human resources capacity was provided. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I know I saw in that
remember last year I carried a bill for the USS Minnesota, and
yes.
That did pass. I just want everybody to know that did pass through the Senate. I think Senator Reinhart carried it in the Senate. It was in the omnibus bill, and it was taken out before it came back to the House floor. I am resubmitting that bill again. I know the Minnesota Navy League has contacted me, would still like to have the state forward some funds for the commissioning ceremony of the USS Minnesota. We did have the commissioning ceremony, and it was a great event. Many of us went out there. And
I believe 28.
And that's 28 people went out there from the legislature. And plus Congress people were out there speaking. And I know there's several other states now that are going to be commissioning their boats or their ships. But I'd like to, again, go forward. I'd like to see it stand as a separate bill that we can take it forward and help out the Navy League, because they did raise funds for the commissioning ceremony.
Representative Detmer, when that bill comes, if it comes to this committee, we will discuss it at that time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please tell us about your programming and what you're going to do with your additional initiative funds.
Madam Chair, committee, my name is Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm going to lead off our discussion here with a summary of what we are doing with the $4.5 million that you appropriated for three of our budget systems. Our budget planning and analysis system, a system we use to build the biennial budget for the governor and for all of you. Our fiscal note tracking system that we use to do the analysis and distribute all the fiscal notes that you use during session. And our new capital budget system, which will replace the existing system, and we will use that to build the next capital budget in. I'm going to have Assistant Commissioner O'Brien just sort of flip through pages 2 and 3. I'm going to go quickly here. You're free to ask any questions you have. But these two slides speak to the involvement that we have with agencies and your staff in our decision-making process. So we have included agency staff and legislative staff in our oversight committees and our day-to-day, week-to-week decision-making as well. And we have regular communication with your staff, newsletters that go out with agency staff and your staff as well. So we are working in close hand with folks from the legislature and within departments to make sure our systems meet everyone's needs. We don't have page numbers, but there. Project overview. I'm just going to highlight a few things that we're doing for each of the three systems. Our biennial planning and analysis system, we call it BPAS. We did go live with our new system last legislative session. The funding you provided is allowing us to make continued improvements with that system. We are updating what we have already gone live with to make it more user-friendly than it was last session for your staff, and to significantly improve the reporting that we were able to do last legislative session. We're also continuing to develop that system out to use it for other purposes and more purposes than we were able to use our original budget system for. So we are using that system to compile the governor's supplemental budget and report out on the supplemental budget for you. We were not able to do that with our previous system. We're also going to be able to report out of this system on what an adopted budget looks like. We have not been able to do that in the past. We're also loading functionality in this system for agencies to do more planning and analysis, especially around salary costs. And we will also be able to take the data in our budget system from the adopted budget and load that into our accounting system. So we will be able to go full circle from taking the information in the accounting system, load it into the budget system, do development there, track the adopted budget, and load that back up into our accounting system. Things that we have not been able to do in the past, and will make this particular system functional year-round as opposed to being able to be used only once every 2 years. Moving on to the next, was there a question?
Ms. Kelly, now?
I'm sorry, I can wait.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Please.
Moving on to the next page, our fiscal note tracking system. We are currently working on revising this system, and we will go live with it next January. We have finished our design of how we will build out the new system, and we are starting to actually do the build of the new system. So included in your packets, I believe, is an example of what a new fiscal note will look like. We have taken all the information that had been provided in fiscal notes in the past and added additional information. So members will not be losing any information, but they'll be gaining more information. We did this in conjunction with your staff, who asked for additional information be summarized in the fiscal note. We are also allowing the export of data and the import of data within Excel, which is a functionality that agencies allowed for. And hopefully the design of the fiscal note will improve the readability for all of you. And moving on to our capital budget system, we will go live with this system in May of 2015. And we have a project team in place. We have not begun the designing or the build of that. We will start to do that in the next month or two. The one thing we are trying to achieve with this system is to make it a web-based system, which will allow local units of government to enter their requests directly into the system, as opposed to filling out paper forms and mailing it into MMB, and MMB turning that into a document that then can be delivered to all of you and posted to the web. So overall, what we're doing with these three projects, we have our successes. We're remaining within budget so far. We have risk management strategies in place to ensure we stay on time and within budget. And our scope so far has been on target, and we have not overreached yet. There are a few risks, as there typically are with IT projects. There's been some delay in obtaining technical staff and contractors, and I think all of state government is experiencing that as our job place or job market becomes more robust. There are competitions across these three projects for resources within my division, but we're working diligently to manage that. And there always will be technical limitations when we purchase off-the-shelf software, which we are doing for these projects. And we are trying to manage the limitations that provides to all of you with the competing demands from all of you as agencies as well, to get as much functionality as we can out of off-the-shelf software programs. And that's my summary. I think you also have a copy in your packet of our monthly newsletter. We're happy to include any of you on that distribution list, yep, if you'd like to be added. The last page of my slide includes contacts for who you can contact at MMB.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got three short questions. First one, the fiscal note software. Will data collection, the algorithms used, or any of that change how we arrive at what fiscal notes will look like in the past and in the future as compared to the past?
Madam Chair, Representative, actually that work is done by agencies in terms of how they calculate and determine costs, and that's done offline. And each agency probably approaches it somewhat differently. And our review of that will continue to be the same.
Okay.
Representative Benson?
SWIFT accounting problems, were they resolved?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure which accounting problems you're speaking to, but I could say that we have delivered our CAFR report, which was one thing that we were late with last year.
Budget software issues that affect House fiscal staff from pulling data. Was that just a transfer issue of data, or?
Madam Chair and Representative, there were some issues in our reporting out of the budget system last legislative session, and it did have to do with transfers, and yes, we are working to resolve that. I'm not sure if we have it resolved yet or if we're still in the process of reviewing, but it is a problem that we are diligently working to sort out.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Could we just ask that we get a follow-up on where that's at before session starts?
Certainly.
And one last question. Could you give me, could you send the committee a report on we as a committee, and then it was voted out on the floor and passed by or signed into law by the governor, the commissioner's salaries? Could we get a list of where those commissioner's salaries? I know that the major commissioners went up by 133%. of the governor's salary, which is about a 50% increase on ceiling. I think the minor ones went up 20%, which would be a 35-40%. But could we get an actual of where they went and how those will be impacted? I'm assuming you folks do the calculation on that, on how those would be affected beginning in 2016, because the governor is due to get an increase also.
Ms. O'Brien.
Madam Chair, Representative Ann O'Brien, Assistant Commissioner for Enterprise Human Resources at MMB. I can get you those actual salaries. The cap went up, but the actual salaries did not raise to that level. But, yes, I can get you the actual salaries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm done.
Thank you. Ms. Hansen? Oh, Representative
Leiterker. Thank you. I'd like to... thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to also talk about the SWIFT software. I've heard in my district that there are problems with it as it deals with the townships and in terms of how funding is supposed to be shifted back and forth. And so you're going to be addressing that. Could you also address how it's interfacing with the townships? I would appreciate that when you come back with your report. Thank you.
Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair, I will talk with Assistant Commissioner Lori Moe and include a response to that question in our response on the budget systems transfer issue. Okay,
thank you.
Ms. Hansen, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair,
or Ms. O'Brien,
we have two things to report to you on today. The talent management projects that were funded. One includes the new talent management system software, recruiting solutions. There's a new application processing system, as well as the additional staff to support our enterprise human resource and talent management strategies. Lori Hansen is the Director of Employee Management, and she's here to report on the first one, which is the recruiting solutions.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Hansen.
Madam Chair. Lori Hansen, I'm directing the recruiting solutions project at Minnesota Management and Budget. You have a slide presentation that we've provided to you, but in the interest of time, I'm going to focus on just a few of those slides. Turning to slide 3, where we're talking about implementation of our recruiting solutions project, just a reminder that our current software, the vendor is out of business. Our third-party strategy to get support for that system no longer exists. We have one IT person who can support that software. That's what we're trying to get rid of. The new software will bring us automated software where we have both support from the vendor and we have access to many internal IT resources who can help us support that project. It is a PeopleSoft product. We already have PeopleSoft in-house, and so we have access to all of those IT resources that can help us. The advantages of our new software is that it's automated and it doesn't require a bunch of manual intervention that we have in place right now. Right now, every resume that comes into our system, and there are about 7,000 of them every month, has to be touched by an MMB resource and pushed through that system. That will go away. We'll have greater reporting capabilities. Right now we have a system where no agencies can do any reporting. With the new system, we will have enterprise reporting capabilities. Agencies will be able to get reports and will no longer have to rely on one resource at Minnesota Management and Budget. And finally, the new software will help us to reach a broader applicant audience, and it will help us to screen applications. We've done some looking at the number of applications that we get and the number of the applicants that meet the minimum qualifications for any one job that we have. And oftentimes, we're looking at numbers anywhere between 30% to 50% of the people that apply don't meet the minimum qualifications. This new software will help us to automate that. I want to turn next to slide 6 and talk about our timeline. This is a high-level timeline that we have incorporated for you. We have already finished step 1 and step 2. Step 3 speaks to the Kaizen and the Fit Gap. I want to talk about that again in a little bit, but we are right now on target with our timeline And we'll be finishing up with the Fit Gap and Kaizen this week. It's scheduled to end the 31st of January. I want to next go to slide 7 and focus on those Fit Gap and Kaizen activities. We went through a process that we call a Fit Gap. We had 15 state agencies in for 2 weeks, helping us go through a requirements definition that was put together earlier in the year by a number of state agencies that came together. What we did was we compared our requirements to the statewide, to the new system, and took a look at whether or not or how the system meets our needs. That was an intensive process. What that will do then is it will give us data and information going forward for our development process for recruiting solutions. As you can imagine, and as Assistant Commissioner Kelly talked about, not all off-the-shelf software meets your needs exactly as you need it. So we will have to make some changes. We also went through a Kaizen event, and a Kaizen is a lean or a continuous improvement event. We were certain when we embarked on this project that we would not take our current processes and just automate them. We wanted to be sure that we didn't have waste in our process. We wanted to be sure that our processes were efficient and we could certainly explain and understand everything that we were doing. So we went through a 7-day Kaizen process with these same 15 state agencies and took a look at our hiring process from the point at which an agency prepares a job announcement to the point where they're making a job offer to a candidate. So not the entire process, but we looked at that segment. And we learned some things about our hiring process. Right now, it takes an average of 57.7 days to hire somebody in state government. But through this process, we also identified many opportunities for improvements. And the next steps for our Kaizen is to develop work groups, to go forward, and to take action on those improvement ideas that came forward. Any questions about that project?
Representative Bernardi. It's a very quick question, you may or may not have the answer. Do you know what's typical in hiring processes elsewhere in government or in business?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Hanson.
We have not looked at what is typical. We just examined what our process was.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Ms. O'Brien.
Members of the committee, we also have a report on the additional staff that we have to support our talent management efforts. We have been looking at providing leadership. We've done some focus groups with the HR community, with our stakeholders, managers, and members of management for the state of Minnesota, and found that they have asked for us to take more of a leadership role at MMB to provide them with more tools in this talent management to be more effective leaders in state government. And so we have taken and divided this group of positions into 3 major categories of workforce planning and recruiting to provide more of a statewide leadership and to reduce redundancies in state governments, so that we are doing and coordinating those efforts for the state, for all the state agencies in these areas. That we are then also providing the legal advising and consultation for the agencies and providing talent leadership. And then also some of those positions will be providing administrative support for those functions. The positions that with talent management, workforce planning, and recruiting, we hired a recruiter who will provide overarching enterprise-wide consultation and direction for all state agencies to provide us with a better recruitment position and to enable all state agencies to attract and retain better in state government. Typically in the past, we've had agencies have their own presence in the different state agencies, and we wanted to be able to enable that across the enterprise. This position will facilitate the state recruiters group and will enable us to go into social media and provide a greater presence on the recruitment front for us to do a better job of recruiting and retaining people. We are also have a workforce planning position that we created to provide expertise and technical assistance to state agencies so that they can do a better job of planning for the loss of employees or to make sure they don't lose as many employees by doing a more effective method of recruiting, retention, and talent management by doing some risk mitigation and deciding what will their occupational categories look like in the future, what are the differences that are going to happen in those areas so that they can be more informed and better plan for the changes that are happening in those occupations and succession planning and do a better job of workforce planning. That will be an enterprise-wide task that that individual will work with management at the state agencies. We also, in order to help those agencies, have hired a transaction specialist to help the system. This is more to assist with reporting for the managers and supervisors in state government, as well as the human resource reporting, and help us make sure that we have the people where they need them, to provide agency HR staff with guidance on employee data and in the HRIS system so that we know we maintain the accurate records for the employee so we know what our skills, abilities, and our employee data is in the Semaphore data system. And in the employment law and talent leadership area, again, we're helping state agencies with an employment law position where we have enterprise-wide guidance regarding interpretation of state and federal laws affecting human resource programs such as affirmative action, equal opportunity, employment law, data practices, and to develop and deliver training to the statewide community and then provide technical assistance so that we have that helping the HR become and stay skilled in the area and the changing area and legal areas of human resource and policy development. So those are the big changes that we have in the HR talent management strategies. If you have any questions, you can contact me.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate your presentation. The four councils. I've asked the four councils to come and talk for a very, very brief time. 2 minutes. We are about what they're going to do with their additional funds. Each council received $200,000 every year. Every other year, I mean, every biennium. And it wasn't a one-time appropriation. It was a continuing appropriation. So we asked for the short term plan and long-term plan that, and we know that those are still being formulated completely, but what is your vision for the use of the additional funds other than your staffing that you've been operating with on a regular basis?
Sure.
See her?
Madam Chair and respective committee members, thank you. My name is Sia Herr, and I am the Executive Director of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. The Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, which we also call CAPM, was created to provide factual information, policy recommendations, and communication pathways from our very, very diverse communities to the legislature and from the legislature to our communities. The needs that existed when CAPM was first created in 1985 are still present in 2014. And right now, our council is in a state of transition. We have a completely brand new team. I am 11 months into my position as executive director. With such a brand new team on board, we are extremely confident that we will be able to more effectively and efficiently fulfill the statutory responsibilities that you as a body gave to us. Our community at this point is still very unsure on how to navigate the political process in Minnesota, and the legislature is still learning how to build relationships into our communities. The council has a responsibility to do a better job as the facilitator for the interactions between the various communities that we represent and you as a body. And this is our charge and this is our commitment. We did provide you with a copy of our annual report, but for today's purpose, here are some of the steps that we've taken as a council since the budget increase in 2013. We've increased our staff capacity from 3.25 to 4 FTEs. This is critical for me to share with you because this increased capacity has allowed our council to engage with legislators and other stakeholders much more systematically. It's also allowed us to conduct more research on issues of importance to the AAPI population, which will inform all of you in terms of policy making. Right now, we're working on an early childhood education report focused on the Southeast Asian communities. We've also begun to re-engage with our community, and what's interesting to know is that the Asian American population resides in every single one of the 87 counties in the state of Minnesota, and so we're re-engaging with the AAPI community members in greater Minnesota. We've also taken the opportunity in hiring new staff to better tailor the positions and the compensation to the needs of our council so that we are better positioned to carry out our statutory duties. We're, as I have mentioned already, we're working on an early childhood education report, and we plan to release this report before the convening of the next legislative session. We've also begun to start engaging with Greater Minnesota. So we're planning to go into areas such as Worthington, Baudette, and Rochester. One of the projects that we're working on right now is a redesigning of our website. The current website is outdated, not user-friendly, and not as informative of the council's activities and objectives. And those are the key projects that we're working on that are made possible with the increase that you provided in 2013. As all of you know, we are at the tail end of an audit by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We at the Council look forward to hearing about their findings and recommendations, and of course, we look forward to working with all of you to address the challenges that they may help that they may have helped to identify in this report. At this point in time, I'm open to taking any questions from you.
Thank you, Ms. C. You're new in your position. Since when?
The tail end of March, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anne Marie Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Anna Marie Hill. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and I'm not so new to my position. I've been with Indian Affairs Council as the Executive Director for the past 7.5 years, going on 8 years this June. So with that, we did receive an increase, as you know, $100,000 per year, $200,000 for the biennium. At the same time, I do have to state that we unfortunately saw a decrease in the funding that we had received to operate our Why Treaties Matter exhibit with the legacy dollars with Minnesota Humanities Center. So we saw quite a substantial decrease in that exhibit that we have been running and are still currently running, has been going since 2010. And it's also a national award-winning exhibit. So we did win a national award for that, and we're quite proud of the treaties exhibit. It is still running, it's still operational, and as a part of the increase, we will be continuing to operate that, hopefully for the next 2 years, and that is without the legacy funding. We are entering into an agreement with Minskew College to have that exhibit at every single Minsky institution in the state in the next 2 years. We'll be sending that throughout the state to all Minsky colleges, and also we are going to be working with Blandin Foundation in the region operating up there in northern Minnesota to continue that treaties exhibit, and we're quite proud of that exhibit, and we'll be doing that work, that core work, through Indian Affairs Council, through Minnesota Humanities, and the institutions. So, and again, we saw a decrease with our legacy funding, and we were very saddened by that, but we are also finding a way to keep that going and meeting the needs that has. We have many sites, over 40, 50 sites it's traveled to in the past 3 years, over 50,000 people it's touched, and it's new content relating to education. And we know that there's quite an achievement gap in the state of Minnesota with regards to American Indian students. We are on the bottom in the entire nation in graduating our students. So we have the worst achievement gap, and we're meeting that need in Indian Affairs for people to learn about tribes, treaties, and American Indian people here in Minnesota. With the increase also, prior to receiving the increase in dollars, we had operated with pretty much the same budget since I've been here. And things were getting very tight because, of course, we have cost of living increases and increases throughout every part of operational area in Indian Affairs Council. So with that, prior to receiving the increase, we were down a staff person, down two staff people, and it didn't look like we would be able to fill behind those staff individuals. One of them is in cultural resources. Since that time, we have become fully operational. I've increased the staff, and I have added three new staff individuals. I have almost a whole new staff. For the first time in 7 years, you'll see new people around the office. They are in the audience right now. Melissa Cirda is our cultural resources person, and she comes from the Southwest United States. The next person is our education liaison, my executive assistant, Melanie Franks. If you can stand, Melanie. And she comes to us straight from Alaska, but she is also Canadian. And the third person, my new legislative director, in lieu of Jolynne White leaving her position, Melanie Plazinski. She is Bad River. From Bad River, Wisconsin. So that's a new staff that I have that you'll be seeing around the Capitol and working with. The board identified that one of the most important areas is in the area of education, as I stated, to work on this disparity or achievement gap that we have. We'll continue operating in the same manner. We run two offices, one in St. Paul and one in Bemidji. We're able to keep those staffed and fully funded. We'll assist. We are also have the governor signed a new executive order mandating state agencies to work on a government-to-government basis with the tribes, and that involves a lot of work that's happening right now. That work will be mainly handled through Indian Affairs, and also we will be handling, like I said, the treaties exhibit, and also there is a new program with the state of Minnesota. We are having training for state employees, tribal state training, and that's also the result of the executive order of that we've been working on for a long time, and that core work will be handled with my staff through Indian Affairs. So a lot of good things happening. Good. Any questions?
Representative Benson.
Madam, yes. Chair, and this is will be for all the councils in their testimony. I'd be interested in finding out, the first two at least have said that they're going to use the money, the $100,000 per year, to either fill or augment staffs. I'd be interested in finding out just exactly how many additional hours are being used by whether it's a full-time, an FTE, or a part-time. I think the first testifier said they were going from a half to a full-time. And then what salary increases resulted in the new monies being made available. And that would be for all of the four councils.
And they could. Would you please submit that to us in writing, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Edward McDonald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Edward McDonald, the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans. Thank you for providing the opportunity to speak to you today about the use of additional funding from 2013. Our November 13th annual report provides the details on our short accomplishments using the appropriations. I've also provided for you under this cover on the screen my statements today. 2014 legislation that we are introducing, an overview of the council's duties as well as our strategic doing plan. Madam Chair, we are ahead of schedule with the implementation of our strategic doing plan, which aligns our organization's operations with the duties and purpose that the legislature has assigned the council. We will update that plan again at the end of this fiscal year. Some of the organizational and programmatic accomplishments we're proud of is assisting with the Minnesota Ending and Preventing Homelessness Plan, assisting with the development and passage of the North Star legislation, coordinating outreach to enroll African descent people in MNSURE, helping to improve the state affirmative action approach, and working with DHS to create a rally for adoption of foster care initiative. Other notable activities so far in this year with the new money is strengthening our relationships with constituencies through our Power of Unity Summit, the Martin Luther King celebration, and our legacy tours around the state, enhancing our managerial activities. We've grown our staff from 2 people to 3 full-time, 3 and a half-time staff person, one located in the Rochester area. I should point out to Representative Detmer that one is a veteran, taking his advice to consider them in our hiring process. We've achieved a positive 2013 legislative auditor's financial audit. We're operating with a $40,000 surplus. We're deploying one of the most active websites and social media infrastructure driven by a social media plan. We now can invite our constituency from around the state to participate in all of our meetings. Madam Chair, we're most proud of the development of legislative recommendations driven by our community for this session. While we understand this is not a sprint and we would hope to accomplish a lot of those things this session, we do recognize it as a bonding session. We are gearing up for 2015 to pass that legislation. That legislation will serve as the foundation for the bulk of our programmatic activities going forward. We are looking to, in those recommendations, which are included in the packet, to enhance human rights enforcement, lay the foundation for eradication of disparities versus the notion to close gaps. We want to eradicate them. We think that the Minnesota innovation, America genius, is one that if we take on complex issues of this nature, we can bring forth strategies that eradicate them. Our legislative recommendations focus on education, employment, health, criminal justice, arts funding, fresh food access, and home ownership, all which have huge disparities. And we believe that our recommendation move us to a point where we can lay the foundation to eradicate those disparities. In addition to that, we have advanced our modifications to our enabling legislation that will give us the authority to assist with recruiting successful black businesses to the state, assist with trade missions to African nations. Mm-hmm. Minnesota now has 23 African nations that are settled here and organized within in Minnesota. We like to work with them to see how we can strengthen their interactions back with those countries and using that as a way of enhancing the socioeconomic vitality of the state of Minnesota. In addition to that, we would like to expand our enabling legislation to recommend bonding initiatives that have a direct benefit to the black community. Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you today. The Council on Black Minnesotans is doing very well. We have turned the corner and are ready to just roll up our sleeves and get to work with everyone else in Minnesota, making this continue to be a great state.
You covered all bases. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to seize on what you said in terms of covering all bases. I appreciate the time and work that you put into your report, and this would go to all four of you. I just heard so many things about, you know, what you would like to do, all very laudable goals, and certainly shared around this this table today, the hope that all those things can be done. But I'm wondering that sometimes when we listen and we hear those things, are there any metrics by which, this is not a huge amount of money, but it is. It's money. And what I would like to hear is maybe even fewer things. And this is a recommendation, so it's maybe less of a question, but I would like a comment from whoever that still wants to seize the microphone. So that when we hear about things that are being planned and executed in individual plans, that when we come back and we take a report, an annual report that you give, there is actually some kind of metric about by which we can measure whether or not these councils are being effective in representing their constituencies. I mean, I'm all for this, and I want to see, you know, improvements. But I also want to put resources, the taxpayers' resources, in things that I believe and we can see that are really making a difference. And I'm not throwing this all on your shoulders, because these are problems that are way beyond that can be dealt with a council of four people. You're going to take mustering far more resources. But, you know, as it relates to what you can do as a small council and the leadership that you provide locally for these things, I would just hope that when you're beginning to think about reports back to this body, that it would be in terms that we can understand that you've made a difference.
Madam Chair.
Ms. McDonald.
Representative, when we embark on our work, we develop it knowing that in Minnesota the human stories are singular, but our destiny is shared. We rise or fall as one people and as one state. And the power of human unity must prevail. We don't see what we do hardened and partial to the operations of the state of Minnesota. Our central duties is to come to you and advise you based on the input of our community. None of us totally feel comfortable living under the constructs we have, but those are the cards that are dealt. But we also understand that we are human beings. We're interconnected to one another. So our recommendations are just recommendations that come into the social political deliberation for you to consider from the perspective that we bring to them. If you embrace them, we believe we can eradicate disparities. If you don't, then we'll probably have to continue to work the way we are working. But we are Minnesotans. We are Americans. We are our brother's keepers. And we're just bringing you a perspective.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, just a short comment. That all, again, very laudable. I understand where you're coming from. I'm not pandering to your comments at all. But if I were a director of a council or any agency that reported back to the state government about by which the funds are being spent, I would want some measurable metric. That's all I'm saying. Is that, you know, from what you do and you did, if it's an annual report, that there is some metric by which we can assess how things are improving or not, so that we can fully understand whether or not as a body we're doing things that make sense through you.
And for a question for a later time, for another time, Representative Benson, I think we on this committee should have a discussion about that, and whether it's our responsibility to provide that metric or whether it's the council's responsibility to draw up the metric.
Excellent.
Or
point.
Whether we should do it together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excellent point.
Madam Chair,
Representative Detmer.
To that one point, during the regular session, I did bring up to each council that in terms of what they are doing to serve the veteran population within their population, and that was supposed to be brought back to the committee, and that's still something I'd like to see done through these four councils.
We certainly can ask for that again.
Yes.
and I'm sure that they're willing to come back with a follow-up on that, either in writing or in example. Mr. Garcia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to speak at this venue. And you've asked us what we've done with $100,000 additional funds that we received to our usual appropriation of $275,000. We submitted several documents to the committee, including our annual report, which we submitted to the legislature in November 15, as well as the salary projections report and a current budget report. There you will see that we used $67,104.36 for the salary of a regional relations staff member who is full-time, as well as a 70-hour per pay period research analyst at $25,471 up to the end of March. Other expenses for our Rochester project amounted to $2,900 for a total of $95,476. The rationale and the impact, I think, will be important to you. We have about 300,000 Latinos in the state of Minnesota. As was mentioned before, we have the largest or near largest disparities in the country. With the growth of the Latino community at 75% between 2000 and 2010, and the retirement of the European American employees in the task force, combined with the impact of globalization in our competitive capacity in international markets, I think this represents both a dire threat and a great opportunity. Everybody's probably aware of why the threat. I'll talk a little bit about the opportunity, which is that we bring diverse cultural perspectives and the Spanish language to the table, which for the first time probably should be recognized as a huge asset, as has been recognized by corporations in Minnesota. In terms of quantifying our progress, all I can tell you right now is that our Rochester project is highly promising, so much so that Mayor Brady has been talking about it on television. We had at our last meeting in Rochester 25 members of the leadership from government, education, the community, the private sector. The Mayo Clinic has been asked to contribute $1 million to our preschool and early education project. And we have another pilot project here in Humboldt High School. So education and Rochester are our focus because we needed to consider how we were going to eat this huge elephant, so it's a bite at a time. And we needed a geographic focus and also to focus on education, which is where all of the disparities arise from. I could tell you a lot more, but I see that I'm out of time. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It sounds like the money is being used for developing vision. We appreciate that a lot. Mr. McElhenney, welcome back. Tell us briefly about the IT improvements and the CVSOs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike McElhenney from Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs again. Madam Chair, we submitted prior to the hearing a just a spreadsheet of the CVSO funding, and if it's okay, I'll just start there. What you can see, we have received grant requests from 78 counties of the 87 right now. There's 9 outstanding that has not submitted a request. So we have been spending that money down. We anticipate the last 9 counties to request the grants very shortly. And so that's where we stand with that. I believe you have that spreadsheet, Madam Chair. And then relative to the IT funding, my good counterpart, Mr. Eichten, is there from Minute, if I fumble with this a little bit. But as you'll recall, we received...
He's next.
We received $5 million for the biennium. And the funding for the IT was for security compliance, efficient and effective IT service management, service recoverability and risk management, continuous process improvement, and system availability. To date, about $1 million has been encumbered for those objectives. Security compliance piece, security standards and HIPAA assessment has been completed. The efficient and effective IT service management, a third-party assessment has been completed. Service metrics have now been defined with that. The service recoverability and risk management. SharePoint implementation is currently in progress. The agency was a little behind there. Continuous process improvement. The release management process has been developed. Incident management and service request tools have been implemented. Purchasing process has been implemented. Workstation management process improvements are in development. As far as the system availability, infrastructure cleanup is underway. Desktop upgrades at all locations are in progress. I myself recently received an upgrade just last week, and technical assessments are in process. And that is currently what's happening with the IT funding, Madam Chair.
What do you mean that you yourself was given an upgrade last week?
It's part of the process, the upgrades of system. I believe it's part of our system availability. They're just natural upgrades that take place relative to our IT within the agency. And so I was just using that as an example.
You mean your technology was given the upgrade?
Yes, Madam Chair. My personal computer in the office has been recently upgraded, and that's going on right now. Agency-wide in MDVA.
I see. And so is mine, but my skills aren't working. It haven't gotten any better.
I'm with you on that, Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question on your second page, the Veterans Paramedic Apprenticeship Program. It was canceled and appropriations sent back to the general fund. Could you explain that to the committee?
Madam Chair, yeah. Representative Detmer, if you recall last year, there was, from years prior, there was a paramedics apprenticeship program that was implemented. It wasn't an agency-specific process that was going to be implemented, and as of last year, there were funds that were still out there to help affect that, and they had not been expended. So that was just money we had left to turn in back to the legislature.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McKelney, how many of the tribes are you working with on the, under the County Veteran Service auspices?
Madam Chair and Representative Purcell, we have the Tribal Veteran Service Officers, and they go to all of the reservations to help implement or take any claims that the American Indians may have. So I don't know exactly how many. I believe we have 7 staff that executes that function statewide.
Thank you very much.
No. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Eichten. Tell us about the E-Government Advisory Council. and the status of the North Star Online Government Information Initiative.
Madam Chair and members, John Eichten with Minute Services. Appointments to the E-Government Advisory Council have been made. It's 5 state agency appointments, 3 citizen appointments. We think we have a very balanced mix, private sector folks, folks who work in broadband, folks who work in the, I would say, the open data community or advocates. An RFP is being developed right now to solicit responses for a potential e-government partner. We expect that to be out in the next couple of months. We've been in contact with several states who utilize the e-government public-private partnership model, and there's actually about 30 states that utilize this model, and we're moving forward very deliberately. It's a long-term partnership that we would be entering into, and several different permutations of this model in different states, and we want to make sure we move forward in an ideal manner and not in a hasty way. We expect a first meeting of the e-government advisory council in the next couple of months, right around the time we get that RFP out the door. I'm happy to answer any questions, but not a whole lot to report on this one right now.
Representative Benson has a question.
Or a No, 2 questions. You can hold me to it. So the first one is, since I'll make sure I frame it concisely so it would take one easy. Through the consolidation and IT consideration being much larger and so on, the conference committee awarded a much larger credit line, $110 million. Can you tell us about the progress of using any of that?
Representative Benson, my understanding is that that has not needed to be used or employed at this point, but I would have to look into that to confirm it. I'd be happy to come back to you again, Representative Benson, with any information as far as if we feel we may need to use it. But at this time, my understanding is we have not.
Madam Chair, follow-up to that question.
Representative Benson.
Okay, this is my second question. This is the follow-up. So I'd also be interested in finding out whether or not, usually a line of credit means there's a service charge for any line of credit. So I'd be interested in what, if you haven't used any of it, but we appropriated or we allowed for a larger line of credit, how much additional service cost was that to the state for a credit line that you're not using? That's the follow-up. So I like
Representative Benson, this is a credit line within the statutory general fund, so there is interest that Minute would have to pay if it used this line of credit through MMB and through moving money within the statutory general funds, but I'm not aware of any service costs in addition to that interest.
Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
Yeah. So, well, typically there would be. So, I'm just trying to get at whether or not, in fact, that was charged you. Okay. So, there's the second question. Are you engaged at all in any of the data security issues with Minsure? Are you involved with that at all?
We do,
Mr.
Chair, Representative Benson. We play a role. Our cybersecurity team at Minute works in partnership with the folks at Minsure and the vendors to address issues that might come up. And we certainly set the infrastructure standards. We've, as we testified to the Minsure Legislative Oversight Committee, our Chief Information Security Officer, Chris Boozy, has been involved from the beginning. And happy to answer any questions to the extent that I can in that area.
Not today. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just behave now.
Thank you. Mr. Yocum. Come and tell us about lean and smart. Lean, $520,000. Smart, $370,000.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Kurt Yocum, legislative liaison with the Department of Administration, and hearing the admonishment, I will do my best to be as quick as possible. So, thanks for the opportunity to update you on the department activities related to the items from last year's state government finance, omnibus finance bill. And again, as you mentioned, I think I was asked to talk about the Enterprise Lean Program, SMART internal audit, and then also the status of several grants. And I think several of the previous speakers today have, or at least 2 of them, had brought up examples of the Lean Enterprise Continuous Improvement Program. So you can actually see that at work. It's a staff currently of 2 people. Just for this last year, Just a couple updates. Our longtime lean administrator, the person who had been the director of the program since 2008, since its inception, retired. And we hired Mary Jo Caldwell, who came up through the Minnesota Lean program and was trained through that, but then took off for Arizona to initiate that state's continuous improvement program. And fortunately, it must have been something with the weather. We were able to lure her back to Minnesota from Arizona. She started this summer. That's not part of the new funding, though. With the new funding, we're also been able to hire one new facilitator slash trainer for the Lean program, and very shortly we expect to have a new staffer beginning who's going to be actually focusing much more on the data analytics side of the Lean Continuous Improvement program. And that's been a long-standing request from our partner agencies around the enterprise, wanting to have data. A, not only what exactly their accomplishments have been, what the cost savings have been, what the time improvements have been, but also to help us at a much more enterprise level enable to target much more strategic lean opportunities in order to have the greatest impact to improve citizen services. We expect to have that position filled within the next couple months. The application deadline was just due on that. Just a couple stats from the last year on the Lean program. Lean, the Office of Continuous Improvement, has trained over 1,600 employees from 22 state agencies, 7 Minsky campuses, representatives from over 50 counties and 7 cities. It's been over 255 formal continuous improvement programs that have been reported back to the office. That's up from only 61 the year before. So the impact has been quite significant. Matter of fact, out of the 28 nominations for the Governor's Continuous Improvement Award this year, collectively we've seen about $7 million in annual savings just from those 28, and then probably another $9 million in future cost avoidance on there. So we do believe that there has been a solid return in the investment. In addition, having that new trainer, facilitator, and hopefully this other person, it'll be starting soon. It's allowed us to come up with a couple additional course offerings, allow more extensive trainings and the Kaizen events. And also, we've been able to begin a brand new initiative with our longtime Lean partner, General Mills, that the Department of Administration and the DNR are currently piloting. I can go into that a little bit more if you prefer. Otherwise, that's the update for the Lean program. Moving on to the SMART program, or the Small Agency Resource Team program. Last year's funding from the Omnibus Finance Bill allowed us to onboard or take on 3 new general fund small agencies, boards, or task force. And so on top of that, first of all, I should explain, the SMART allows us, as I said, is a small agency resource team, and that allows us to work with small agencies, boards, commissions, in order to offer financial management or human resource services. And that's around from whether it's doing basic accounting, helping them with basic HR functions, to overall setting of policies, bookkeeping procedures, following up with best practices. I should say, so as I said, the new funding allowed us to onboard 3 new agencies that would be paid for through general fund dollars. That'd be the Tax Court, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. The Tax Court is fully onboarded right now. The Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals is partially onboarded. And that should be complete with, I believe, within the next couple months. And then beginning in March, we expect the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities to begin with our services. And then in addition on to that, some entities that we work with do actually pay for their services directly out of their budget, basically through a direct hourly billing. And in this last year, it came up that the Racing Commission needed both HR and financial management services, and we've taken them on board. Matter of fact, that's been a bigger job than what would normally be with some of the agencies, and so that's been fairly intensive with new with our resources right now. But that has been going well. In addition, though, with the new funding, we didn't want to just do a process where we were taking on new boards or small agencies just because they might have been the next in line or they had wanted that. We wanted to make sure that we had a kind of a strategic approach to it, that we were able to address those who most needed the services and also with the best match with the resources that we had. Even with the additional funding, there's no way we could serve all the needs that were out there. Developed a close collaboration with Minnesota management and budget in order to figure out how to best offer these services and to see what some of the needs were out there. We've surveyed over 60 small agencies, commissions, task force, to see who wanted services, who needed services, and to see what type of services that they needed. And we had a great response rate, just further illustrating the need for these services. Obviously, we're not able to take all those on, but as we went through that process, we were also able to discover there might be some other options for them to be served other than just the SMART program. For example, there were several smaller entities that do education-type services. They all needed HR services. They were able to pull some funding in order to hire an HR director to serve, HR staff to serve those five entities. And so, therefore, they were able to be served, but not necessarily through the SMART program. In addition, there were other services that some of these entities may have needed, whether it was through MMB's Enterprise Learning Program, Management Analysis and Development, or the Employee Assistance Programs. They just didn't have normally the access or the knowledge about the existence of these programs. Back in November, we did the first workshop with MMB for these small boards and commissions to make sure that they knew what was available. Future workshops are planned, not only with MMB, but with other agencies, including ourselves, who might be capable of helping out with some additional services. And so all around, I think it's been a pretty successful year with that program and really kind of expanding some of the best practices, knowledge base on both HR and financial management practices with a number of different entities. Moving on, the internal audit position, there was $125,000 in new funding for an internal audit position that was appropriated. Matter of fact, about 20 minutes ago, I just got an email that the candidate that we offered the job to accepted, so we'll have somebody starting shortly in that new function. But again, as internal controls, I think this committee has heard over the years from Minnesota Management and Budget about the internal controls process. Our department goes through, just like every other department, a comprehensive risk assessment every year related to every one of its business functions. In our case, we have 15 distinct business units within the department. We develop a risk assessment for each and every one of those. This person is to help with those identified risks to develop the controls necessary. Some of that work we've already been doing, but we haven't had folks who have been able to concentrate on that more comprehensively. And then finally, I was asked to talk about the grants that the department was responsible for distributing through this program last year. We have the Office of Grants Management within the Department of Administration, primarily distributes grants that are either named in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill or the Legacy Bill. And I think that to date, so far this year, that we've executed more than 46 grant agreements, I think specifically in the State Government Finance Bill. There was funding for equipment grants for Minnesota Public Television Stations, Minnesota Public Radios, and AMPRS. At about the total for this fiscal year of $2.9 million, those contracts as of September 1st, those grant agreements have been executed. That money is out the door. And for the biennium total, obviously we haven't distributed the money for the following fiscal year, but that would have been $2.9 million out of a total for the biennium of $5.5 million. And I can expand on any of that if you'd like, but otherwise trying to keep it brief.
That was good. Representative Benson has a question or a statement.
No question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Data analytic bills that were passed in 2012 were very permissive in language. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get a report regarding how many agencies or if any agencies used any of those that were provided in 2013.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Mossman, thank you for being so cooperative and letting us skip over you, and here we are. We're still eager to hear, though.
Madam Chair and members, we are...
We want to know about that debit card.
We are eager to be here and happy to report.
Oh, poor Target, poor Michaels, poor all these debit cards that, or all these cards that just are so wonderful.
She's just mentioned all these.
The answer to everything, right, Ms. Mossman?
Madam Chair and members, Matt Mossman, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Revenue.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as
well.
Thank you. With me is Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblack. In the interest of time, we have a handout that looks very much like one that we brought you last year. I'll just really kind of skip over the front page, just summarizes again for you our mission, strategies, values, budget, and the kind of gives the size and sense of the agency's footprint.
So we can read.
Yep. And then on the top, Madam Chair and members, really an answer to your the items that you wanted the committee to update. The department has always said, as you recall last year when we testified, that our top priority would be ultimately making a decision based on what was in the best interest of taxpayers and consumers. We are not implementing debit cards at this time. We are not implementing debit cards at this time, Madam Chair. So we'll continue with our current processes at this time. I think as you have cited, Madam Chair, context obviously is important, and I think that feeds in a couple ways. One, even if we were comfortable with the security of the tool, it just wouldn't be an ideal time to roll out. And I think also there's certainly an opportunity or potential that there will be some new technologies or things that will be learned in the process, and it's prudent for us to make sure we can take advantage of those. So what we are doing and have been planning to do since last fall in lieu of that, we started to evaluate this closer, is put a much greater emphasis on direct deposit. Right now we have more people that file electronically than what transact with us electronically, and we want to, and there's a lot of educational opportunity that can happen around that, and so we're going to put a greater emphasis on direct deposit, and Ms. Steenblack can talk more about that. Other than that, Madam Chair, we are focusing on the unsession and obviously moving forward some of the efficiencies that we came to with the committee, came before the committee with last session.
Ms. Steenblack.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Terry Steenblack, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes. Just want to touch briefly on the direct deposit initiative that we have underway. As we've been out and about the last year, we've heard from a lot of taxpayers who have asked us if there is the ability for them to directly deposit their refund check into their checking or savings account, and so we realize that we have an opportunity there to do some outreach. We are doing quite extensive outreach in that area. On the overhead or the handout, you'll see some examples of flyers and information that we've sent to all of the preparer community to make sure that they're aware of it. We've done some additional education on how they can direct deposit and what their options are there as well. And there's a list of variety of outreach efforts that are listed there. I do want to skip to the better services increased efficiency on the back of your list. This is where we have some updates pertaining to some of the legislation that was passed last year. So we'll just briefly make you aware of some things that are there. Do you want to point out that the agency has been focused on a lean effort in relation to our centralized print and return mail process. We did receive the Governor's Continuous Improvement Award for that particular activity, where we looked at streamlining the outgoing mail functionality and the return mail process within the agency with a savings of almost $700,000 a year. Last year, you provided legislation for the property tax grant funds. Do want to let you know that the application process for that is underway. It closed on December 20th, and we will be issuing the grants to the counties in March of this year. So that one is completed and progressing quite nicely. The VITA sites, this was the piece where you provided legislation for the sites that provide tax assistance for low-income or senior citizens, helping them complete their tax returns. The entire process has been completed, and the grants were issued in October of this year.
We'll have more information as to how those grants are being used when we get the final reports from all of the VITA sites, but they are using it to make sure that they're extending hours and doing outreach activities that allow them to touch more taxpayers and complete more returns. The wage levy payment and disclosure was legislation that was passed last year that allowed for, required the electronic presentment of wage levy payments and wage levy disclosures. That electronic process has been completed and it will be implemented in March of this year. It is available right now. We're allowing employers to test it and become familiar with it before we finalize that implementation in March. The M1PR, which is our property tax refund, we did implement an electronic solution that is available to homeowners. That went live on March 26th of last year, so we'll be experiencing our first full year with that coming up here again. And to date, we've served 88,000 taxpayers have used that new free file homeowner filing solution. And then finally, just wanted to make you aware that last year when we were here, we talked about our e-services, which is our online system that allows business taxpayers to file their tax returns and make payments. That also allows them to see copies of their letters and a variety of other things. We did roll out enhancements to that. Those enhancements went out in March. March 26th of last year as well, and we've received very positive feedback there. And now we're continuing to look at additional functionality and feedback that we can incorporate into our e-services system. And with that, we'll open it up for questions.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so it's good that you're here today, because yesterday I got an email from a constituent wondering, I know we're going to more electronics, but he was looking for his tax forms. He was went down to the local library, and they're not in the libraries yet. So he was wondering why that is or when they're going to be available so he can get his taxes ready.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson.
Yes.
We do have a service that's available where the libraries can now be requesting those forms from us, and we'll send them out to them. So I'm not sure if this would have been a case where the library hasn't requested them yet, or we are in the process of sending them out. I'm not quite sure. I'd have to take a look at that particular library. But we do have a process in place where the libraries can call. And the reason why we do that is because different libraries want a different count of forms available depending upon their clientele, so they can call us up, tell us what they want from a number standpoint, and then we mail those out to them.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yes, follow-up to Representative Nelson's question. Forms that may be needed for 2014, I'm not talking about tax filing for 2013, that was his question in the libraries, but there are other forms that people need for the new taxable year. And when will those be available, or how long does it take for that transition into a new year?
Madam Chair and Representative, if I understand your question correctly, so when we generally try and have our forms completed and finalized by October 1st of the year prior to the end of the calendar year. So for tax year 2013, we would try and have our tax year 2013 forms completed by roughly October so that they can be printed, produced for calendar year 2014 is when people file their tax year 2013 returns for individual income tax and most taxes. So if you're talking about tax year 2014, we would be working on those over the summer. Tax year 13 that just ended the calendar year, we had those form, that form process was kind of finalized for the most part in late fall.
I can ask the, I'll do a follow-up offline, but it, like Representative Nelson, it was an issue drawn to my attention by not a constituent currently, but a former constituent, so okay. Thank you.
They stick with you, don't they, Representative Carlson?
They do after redistricting for a while.
Representative Newton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the M1PR form, do you also have the renter's credit electronically?
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, at this time we just have the homeowners available. We still have to work through some different things with the renters before we would make that available. We're still trying to, we want to get a full year under our belt with the homeowners, make sure that that process is working well, and then we'll explore the renters piece as well.
Just to add to that, Madam Chair and Representative Newton, as you might know, there's two different players with the renter's credit. There's, of course, the landlord's piece and the renter's piece who actually files the return for us, where the homeowners filed directly themselves. So that makes it a little different challenge.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelleher. What programming changes have taken place since you received that bonanza?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. First, I want to just say thank you for the opportunity to give you an update, and more importantly, for the resources you were able to provide to the Minnesota Historical Society so that we can serve Minnesotans better, help them better understand their own history.
That's what we want.
Resources that you were able to provide generally fall into two areas. First, increasing access to historical resources, and second, expanded educational outreach. So first, and I'll hit the high points here in the interest of time, increased access to historical resources allowed us to expand hours at historic sites. They will allow us to expand field services, which is assistance provided to county and local historical organizations, and collections access to the collections through the library at the History Center. We're able to add a staff person's worth of time to make sure that we have online resources up to snuff, and we've adjusted hours at the History Center Library to, based on surveys with users, to make sure that we're open when they want us to be open. Secondly, the expanded educational outreach, as we've discussed in the past, most of our educational efforts are surround Northern Lights, and this is the textbook that's just out this past year that supports the state's social studies curriculum requirements for Minnesota history. Minnesota history is now most commonly taught at the sixth grade level, where formerly it was taught in a band between fourth and sixth, which required increased training for teachers, because we have teachers at the sixth grade level who never taught Minnesota history before. So we were able to expand teacher training. We are developing supplemental curriculum materials so that we can help teachers teach in different ways. And then one thing that we've done, we're hoping to start a tradition. This is not necessarily related to the funding that you all provided, but as part of our overall package for educational outreach, what we've done is we've made available a pass to all sixth graders in Minnesota. They can request a pass, their teacher can request a pass, or their family can request a pass. And this will allow them, every sixth grader in Minnesota, to get into the History Center or a historic site free of charge. And we hope that this becomes a tradition, so that when students are studying sixth grade, studying Minnesota history in the sixth grade classroom, they will back it up with outside of classroom time by visiting. Madam Chair, there are a number of other things under educational outreach. A summer history immersion program for students who have not had an opportunity to do primary research, and that gives them some exposure to college-level libraries, so they can get an introduction to that part of hopefully what will become their future, and a number of other outreach programs for young people. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. It's just what you said you would do with the money if you got it.
We did, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
And we're glad. Representative Slotsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you please review again, when you were talking about the pass for the sixth graders, does that mean school groups, when they come down, would they be able to use that pass, or is it a follow-up if they've already been to your facility or place and then follow up with another visit?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Representative Swatsky, it's the latter. We really don't want to have groups request passes and then get in for free. We want to have students come on a class trip to one of the sites or a history center and then follow up with their families or some other group that might come in, but not reduce the cost. I know that it's a barrier for some school groups to come in, whether it's for transportation or the admission, and we do have a couple of programs, one funded with legacy money and one funded by an individual family donor who wanted to make access more possible. So there are opportunities for school groups that can't afford either the transportation cost or the admission cost to inquire about that. So if that applies, then give us a call and we'll see if something can be worked out.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your cooperation on presenting what's happening with the new funding that came about because of the 2013 legislation. I think that you've shown a lot of collaboration. You've shown a lot of vision. You've kept to what you said you would spend the money on. And you offer us, as I said before, vision for the future. And I really appreciate that. The second item on the agenda today the third item was the receipt of mandated reports. And in our packets, there's a report, there's a list of 64 reports that we have received to this date. And the links have been sent to you, and the links are on this sheet also. And the Legislative Library is the recipient of them, and as well as our committee, and they send out notices to those people that didn't get their reports done and were waiting for them, and that's going to take place next week. So we may have additions, but Representative Nelson?
Madam Chair, I'd like to have this information from these reports included in the minutes. And so that, and make note that we've received them as required by statute.
Thank you very much. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. We have concluded the business that I stated on the agenda that we were going to have, and we've done pretty well. Representative Benson, we said we were going to be done by 2:30, but we did pretty well.
I don't have anything going on, Madam Chair, so I'm no good for more.
Neither do I, so it's okay, you know?
It's warm in here.
So we're going to have other meetings, but we do have a new staff person with us today. Mr. Cleary retired, and Andrew Biggerstaff has from House Research is replacing Mr. Cleary. And will you tell us a little bit about yourself? And I understand you brought a picture.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I was warned to bring a picture, so I brought one. I've been with House Research for just over a year now. I've staffed the Tax Committee, the Property Tax Committee, and the Commerce Committee. So this is, I do a little bit in all of those committees. First of all, my picture, I was told, what's that? Yeah. I was told it was supposed to be something that I like to do outside of my job. So it's a picture of me playing hockey with some of my law school friends. It was after a charity game that we played against one of the other local law schools, I think in 2013. So that's a hobby that I've had for a while now. Let's see, I went to college in Duluth at UMD. I moved to St. Paul to go to Hamline Law School in 2009, and I graduated in 2012. And I'm taking over the Veterans Affairs and Military Affairs from Jim Cleary. I've also been in the Army Reserve for, it'll be 9 years in April, so I have some experience with that, and I look forward to working with all of you.
Good. And the governor was just up at UMD with us on Friday afternoon, and the students received us very well. So it was great. Sunday nights, you know, there's a group that play hockey.
That's what I've heard.
I know nothing about that, and I'm not going to know anything about that, except that Phyllis, Representative Kahn, speaks of it frequently, and I'm sure you'd be welcome, because apparently Mr. Carlson, too, that was here earlier, he plays on that team, and apparently they're getting older or something, and they need some more people to be the second and third and fourth lines.
You might be playing
play
this
at
here.
UMD.
Okay. Anyway, is there any other business? If not, thank you and Happy New Year.
I've got a grandson.
This meeting is adjourned.